Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and this is another episode in my series on radicalism in the American Revolution. And we're here today to talk about the Boston Tea Party with Benjamin Karp, or Ben Karp. Ben, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Benjamin Karp, but you can certainly call me Ben. I am a professor of American history at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York.
All right. So let me say, this is something I probably should have said earlier in this series. This is, I've recorded a few episodes of this series. I've only published a couple of them, but it's largely, a large part of this is influenced by this book that David Graeber wrote called The Democracy Project. And one of the arguments that he makes, and this is a very controversial argument in the study of anarchism, is that democracy and anarchy are roughly the same thing, at least until the this thing that we might call like liberal parliamentary republicanism gets renamed democracy, but sort of the rule by the people would have involved lots of small-scale self-government and probably lots of mob actions and things like that. So democracy and anarchy are pretty similar. And another thing he argues is that there's a huge tension. Sorry, I'm throwing this all at you. I wasn't planning on it. I hope you're ready. There's a huge tension in like the American self-conception in that this is a deeply, deeply counter-revolutionary country. You can't do anything revolutionary in the United States without being accused of being un-American. And we also celebrate all the time when people, I mean, of course the British, but even when we talk about, you know, the civil rights, we love to celebrate people taking revolutionary acts on the street, as long as later we decide they counted as the people. Whereas when the January 6th people do it, at least for the left, or when you have the American Civil War, it's like, well, those people, they should not have rebelled against the U.S. government because they were bad. And we disapprove of all rebellions except for the ones that we approve of. And we really hate property destruction. And our national story begins with a bunch of rioters destroying property. So I'm asking you here to make sense of this moment when Americans did the most American thing, which is also apparently the most un-American thing, which is getting rowdy and breaking shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Boston Tea Party is a great place to start that conversation.
Fantastic. So tell us about this Boston Tea Party, or if you want to go, well, no, let's start there. Tell us about the Boston Tea Party. I assume everyone knows about the Boston Tea Party, but also I'm sure there's also lots of stuff we don't know. So what can you give us that the basic understanding, and also something that maybe we need to understand that we don't understand if we last thought about the Boston Tea Party in eighth grade?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, let's start by the part that everybody knows, which is in a way, the end of the story. I mean, it's not the end of the story, but the end of the story is about 100 Bostonians going on to these three ships, the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the Beaver. These were private ships owned by private owners. The tea on board was owned by the East India Company, a private company that had been granted a monopoly charter by the English government. And so they take the 340 chests of tea that are on board those ships, they haul them up to the decks, they chop them open with axes, and they dump the contents of them into the harbor, doing what in today's value would be millions of dollars worth of property damage. It was 46 tons of tea, and the price of a ton of tea would buy you Paul Revere's house in the 1770s in the north end of Boston. So take the value of a house, multiply it by 46 times. That gives you a sense of the damage that these guys did. So, you know, later theorists will characterize this as civil disobedience or direct action. You know, those concepts belong more to the 19th century or in the 20th century, respectively. But they've since been retroactively characterized that way. Now, there's a lot missing from that story. I think the most important thing to remember about it is that the Bostonians, as part of their duly constituted town government, did try to resolve their tea problem without property destruction first. They come together in a duly constituted town meeting. They approach the consignees, these agents who were who'd been commissioned by the East India Company to receive the tea. They said, "Hey, would you mind sending this tea back to London, because we don't want it here. We think it represents taxation without representation. We think it represents a dangerous precedent for propping up a monopoly company. We don't like that the revenue from the tea pays civil officials that we don't like and we don't have a say in appointing. And we're also getting pressure from New York and Philadelphia, who also don't want to see this tea landed." And those other towns, by the way, distrusted Boston, because the Bostonians had been drinking legally imported tea, which they were supposed to have been boycotting ever since the tax had first gotten imposed in 1767. So the Bostonians have a lot of reasons why they would really like this problem to go away. And they try peaceful and governmental means to solve it. But at one point, the town meeting basically gives up. They're like, "We tried, we asked nicely, there's nothing more for the town to do." And then what happens is that the Boston Sons of Liberty and the various groups who have been involved in protest actions since 1765, Sons of Liberty is kind of a catch-all term. It's not really a formal body in any sense. It's a mix of the North End Caucus and the Boston Committee of Correspondence and other groups. And these groups get together and say, "All right, well," and some of the leadership within those groups say, "Now let's constitute as the body of the people." And this was kind of an old English-speaking concept, right? That when government fails, the people can come together. Now, you had to own property to vote in the town meeting, but once you're the body of the people, you can bring in poor people to fill out your ranks some more. You can bring in people from the neighboring towns, some of which are now part of Boston, but they weren't then: Roxbury, Charlestown, Dorchester. Like, you know, you can bring people who are in commuting distance, you know, and they can pack the largest building in town, right? They leave Faneuil Hall, which is where town meetings had normally taken place, and they go to the Old South Meeting House, a church. They wouldn't have called it a church. They would have called it a meeting house, but the biggest building in Boston, because that's the kind of capacity they need. And now, right, they can use the power of the size of that crowd to hopefully exert even more pressure, right? And meanwhile, there are threatening messages threatening violence to the consignees, and to, you know, and eventually to the ship owners, you know, all of which is, you know, turn these ships around, send them back. We don't want the tea landed. We think it'll be dangerous. We're not going to accept any compromises on that. The tea cannot land in Boston, because then the tax has to be paid. And that gives up this important principle, you know, and it welcomes this monopoly company's product onto our shores in a way that's making Bostonians and Americans in general really uncomfortable. And the colonial officials, the imperial officials, both within the customs service and Governor Thomas Hutchinson, they don't want to play ball. They say, "Look, it's technically illegal. Once dutied commodities come to America, you can't just send them back, right? Like, if you do that, then the Royal Navy can seize these ships and these poor private owners of these ships who really just wanted to get back to England to bring whale oil, right? And things like that, right? Like, they will be ruined. Their ships will be seized and the proceeds will be sold at auction." So the governor decides he's going to take a hard line. On December 16th, you know, one of the ship owners' representatives kind of goes to him in Milton and says, "Can you please just let me send the tea back? Right? Please don't force me to land it." And the governor's like, "I can't. I wouldn't be doing my duty." And at that point, right, the Bostonians had probably already planned on this eventuality. And they say, "Well, we have no choice. We don't want the tea to land, and nobody's allowing it to go back. There are British warships in the harbor that can, you know, make this into a problem. And we can't just allow the tea to just sort of stay on board indefinitely. There are customs rules that prevent that too." And so they decide that the only thing that can be done is to destroy the tea. Now, they do it in a careful way, and a lot of the histories do point this out. They don't damage or touch anything else on board. They actually break some kind of padlock, and they pay to replace it, right? It is mostly not a violent event, although there is one guy who does get severely roughed up, and he's somebody who tried to pocket tea for himself during this action. And when they catch him, they're like, no, that's not what this is about. This is not just about, you know, wanton theft and, you know, and mayhem, right? Like, we're doing this for a particular purpose. We only want this offensive commodity of tea that's traveled 6,000-7,000 miles from China. That's the only thing that we want to be destroyed here. And so they do that, and they do it in a kind of, you know, raucous way. They're dressing as Native Americans, something we would find offensive today, but, you know, they have their reasons for doing it. And then they all kind of slink homeward, and everyone's watching them do this. And this is the thing, we make a big deal out of the disguises, but the thing to remember is that Boston is a town of only 16,000 people. Figure a quarter of that at most are adult men, right? So everybody knew who these guys were. I mean, you know how your cousin walks or how your neighbor carries himself. Everybody knew who these guys were. But the disguises are also meant to kind of be part of the collective action. They're meant to kind of say, hey, don't, if, you know, if anyone should ask you who did this, you should not tell. These disguises are symbolic of our anonymity, that we represent something else. We are not the town meeting. We are not even the body of the people, right? The town of Boston should not be held responsible for what is about to happen here. Of course, the town of Boston is then held responsible under the Boston Port Act, and the British government in 1774 closes the port of Boston and says, you cannot have any commerce whatsoever. We're going to throw all of you out of work, you know, with the exception of like food supplies for the troops or whatever, unless the town of Boston pays back the East India Company for the damage that's been done. And then at that point, there are some American leaders who seriously consider that, like, if we want peace, maybe we ought to do that. And people like Benjamin Franklin and George Washington are a little bit worried that the Boston Tea Party had gone too far. And a lot of Americans nowadays are like, oh, the Boston Tea Party was so inspiring that that's what galvanized the rest of Americans to revolution. Also not really true, right? It's the reaction by the British government, those coercive acts, the Boston Port Act, the Massachusetts Government Act, the Administration of Justice Act, that is what really, you know, drives the colonies to be like, oh, okay, we're going to begin, doing more extra legal stuff now up to and including the Continental Congress in order to revolt against the British.
Okay, that's fantastic stuff. That's so helpful. I think the first place I want to go in response to this is this concept that I'm not really familiar with the, which is the body of the people, which it sounds like the actual, to make sure I've got all of the constitutional niceties clear, the actual direct action, or we don't need to call it that yet, the actual action is not made by the body of the people. It's made by the Sons of Liberty. But the important thing,
right? Yeah, well, hold on, because I've left out a part of the story, right?
Yes, go ahead.
So everybody is meeting again at the Old South Meeting House on December 16th. Right. And Francis Roach, he comes back from Milton. He's like, I'm sorry, the governor's not going to let me turn my ship around. And then Samuel Adams supposedly says at that point, well, then there's nothing more that we can do to save our country. And at that point, a couple of people dressed as Native Americans begin war whooping from the sides of the gallery. And then they're like, we're going down to Griffin's Wharf. And they go off. And then the meeting house kind of empties out and a bunch of people follow them down to Griffin's Wharf to watch this happen. But the leaders, the most prominent men at the head of this meeting were like, no, stay. We are going to continue to talk about the dangers of tea and, you know, and all this, the big cheeses, right? You know, Samuel Adams, John Hancock, they ostentatiously stay behind so that it's not just that it's not the town meeting doing this, but it's like, this meeting was not the ones who did it. We're going to pick the most outsider identity we can, right? These Native American disguises in order to say like, oh, this is just, you know, some anonymous group who did this, so it really, like, plausible deniability was sort of the name of the game for them. So sorry to interrupt, but I left out that part of the story, but, and you are trying to be, we are trying to be very precise here of like, who is it that's taking responsibility and who is it that is trying to decline responsibility for what's happened here.
Yeah, that is perfect. The point I want to make now that I want to make sure I understand correctly is this body of the people is, we would call it constitutional. I just recorded a fantastic episode with Mark Peterson about his new book on the Constitution. And anyone who's listened to this podcast knows that Constitution does not mean a piece of paper with stuff written on it. It is the thing that constitutes, that embodies the system by which people live. Usually there is pieces of paper or some pieces of paper, but you might have a weekly poker game, and there's rules about that poker game, and there's rules about who comes to that poker game. And even if you've never written any of them down, we could say there's a constitutional arrangement in this poker game. You know, a lot of times poker games have the constitutional arrangement that no women are allowed, but that's not written down. And this idea is, it, maybe there's not a piece of paper somewhere that says, when we get really pissed off at the British government, we're allowed to assemble thousands of people and yell at the British government. But if I understand correctly, this is part of the Massachusetts and maybe also part of an older English tradition, constitutional order of the people take the streets.
Yeah. I mean, I would qualify that to some degree. I mean, you're definitely right about constitution, right? That, like, if you think about the word constitute, it helps you make better sense of the word constitution. And look, I mean, every Dungeons and Dragons player knows what constitution means, right? It has to do with, yeah, embodiment in a certain way, the health of the body. It makes a lot of sense. I would say that, like, you know, the people of New England were highly literate. And one of the things that, you know, they thought distinguished them from Catholics, let's say, is that they encouraged everybody to learn to read so that they could read the Bible for themselves. They believed in the priesthood of all believers. But it also did mean that they believed in written laws, right? That, like, that still was important to them. But they do tend to imagine things in the sense of a kind of covenant, in New England at least, they tend to imagine things in the sense of a covenanted community, right? Like, yeah, there are rules, right? And there are obligations that go both ways from, you know, between the minister and his flock, between the governor and the governed, between the captain of a militia company and the rank and file. And there were definite understandings. You're right, not always written down. But they believed in nominating leaders for themselves. But if those leaders were not, sufficiently protecting the people and looking out for their rights, then there was a notion that, like, oh, then at that point we kind of dissolve and have to sort of act on our own. And Lockean principle kind of draws from some of these concepts as well, and it's in there in the Declaration of Independence. We're not doing this for, in the Declaration of Independence, they say we're not doing this for reasons light and transient, right? Like, you can't just, like, you know, go into revolution because you got a parking ticket and you're unhappy, right? Like, you know, we're like, fundamentally, when the people's rights are being violated, at that point you no longer owe your traditional obedience to the constituted power.
Got it. Yes. So there's an almost, in other words, there's an extra constitutional moment that you can reach. And in a certain way, the validity of that extra constitutional moment is in fact constitutional.
Yeah, I mean, right. I wouldn't even call it extra constitutional, right? Like, that knowledge, right, that the rights fundamentally sit with the people, that's not something everybody agrees on, right? But it was a notion, right, that was embodied in, you know, the right to trial by jury, right? That, like, at the end of the day, you know, the people retain certain rights that are totally inviolate. And, you know, and David Hume is nobody's idea of a radical, but even he says, like, look, even in monarchies, public opinion matters, right? There are lines you're not supposed to cross, right? And, you know, and obviously, right, the people of the 18th century were not always, you know, many of the leaders that we respect, both from Britain and the early United States at that time, were not big fans of democracy. they believed that democracy was actually synonymous with anarchy.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and they really think it's a very sort of troublesome idea. But part of that was a reaction to this moment in the mid 1770s at the start of the revolution, when many people were like, yeah, all we have now are our own communities, our own militia, right? You know, like, and they don't reject the king right away, but that's the conclusion that a lot of them have gotten to by the time you get to 1776, right? Like, no kings for us, thanks, right? This king has demonstrated that he is not looking out for us, that he has abdicated his responsibility to oversee us. Yeah, that's where they get to.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is just fascinating stuff. And it's, you know, it's this connection between, as I mentioned, democracy and anarchy is really important to me, following Graeber, because it does seem that one of the rules of democracy that we have now, or, and again, you can tell me what you think about this for now, but you can also compare it to then, is like, when something goes awry, the general, like, New York Times explanation will be, and this is why we have to win the next election, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, so abortion pills are illegal. This doesn't mean you get as many abortion pills as possible and start handing them out, and you accept that you might be put in prison for that, and then you stand up and say, as an American, I acknowledge a higher law than the Supreme Court. You're supposed to say, like, well, the Supreme Court is the highest law, and there's nothing more American than doing what the Supreme Court says. And I read this as a, you know, we kind of have this, we have an American anarchic democratic tradition, and we have an American, you know, capital D liberal democratic parliamentary tradition. And I see them in conflict with one another. Not always. I mean, I would say not usually, but sometimes in conflict. And what I'm hearing is this conflict is kind of existing. I mean, it's amazing how laws bound you described the Tea Party. Is like, what's the real problem here? The real problem is some customs and tariff duties. Like, the issue here is that they're trying to follow the legal rules in certain ways.
Yeah. Although I also skipped over some parts. I mean, they actually do violently assault, try to violently assault the consignees at their homes and places of business in the weeks leading up to the Boston Tea Party.
Yeah.
They're kind of pursuing the different groups may be pursuing actually different strategies. It may be that, you know, Samuel Adams and John Hancock are the town of Boston's representatives in the Massachusetts General Court, in the Massachusetts legislature. So they, right, have to convey a certain, you know, mannered, you know, demeanor, you know, for doing the, going through the proper channels, petitioning the king, petitioning his ministers, trying to do the above board thing. But then in the streets, right, you had a long tradition. I mean, Boston boys grew up like, Barry Levy has a great book called Town Born, and he talks about how, like, Boston boys, like, grew up basically like fighting one another, and, you know, and especially being violent towards outsiders. A lot of them expected to grow up and either, you know, die going to war or die at sea. It was an incredibly violent society that actually did use violence as sort of part of its constitution in ways that we no longer find acceptable, right? Like, we generally do not punish criminals as violently as we used to. We do not coerce labor as violently as we used to, right? But that was commonplace in the 18th century. I mean, right? Like, to be aboard ship as an ordinary seaman meant that if you disobeyed, you were going to get whipped, right? So there is a ton of violent coercion, both bottom up and top down, that they are familiar with in the 18th century. And so this liberal parliamentary tradition that's trying to kind of impose a little bit more peaceful order on things is not something we would necessarily call unwelcome nowadays. So, I mean, I think that's the thing to capture about Boston is that tension is roiling all the time. And in fact, probably Bostonians were comfortable with that tension. They're like, yeah, let's be orderly, but let's always remember that if the people really get pushed to their limits, violence is going to be the response.
So So first I need to say, I'm going to try to make a pledge. You keep saying things that make me want to talk about Herman Melville, and I'm just going to try and not talk about Herman Melville, because if I get started on that, no, please don't say it. No,
his,
please.
His grandfather was at the Boston Tea Party. His grandfather was said to have been one of the participants in the Boston Tea Party. One of the only two that had a Harvard education, actually, that of the participants that we know about. So, you know, like Melville is kind of, it's in his blood. Yeah.
Okay. So there's the Melville thing. Next I want to say, like, just to, you know, jump into the future. It does seem to me that these things need to be kept in balance somehow, this large scale parliamentary form of democracy and the ability to overturn that stuff when it becomes unacceptable. And I actually think if you take the long sweep of American history and you look at things like the civil rights movement and all, I mean, just the entire protest movement of the 60s, and then of course the riots of the 60s, which were in many ways very effective, and you'll get people basically wanting to erase the 60s from American history. But the fact of the matter is, America has always had both of these impulses, and, you know, fingers crossed for what's happening right now in 2026, the two have responded to one another. I mean, I guess the other thing, this is something that I try and say when everyone says, like, oh yeah, since 1789 or whatever, I'm like, well, I would like to remind you the Constitution was in abeyance for 4 years for a large portion of the state. And since the side that claims 1789 won, we like to pretend that the Constitution was not in abeyance from 1861 to 1865, but just let the record show, the U.S. Constitution failed to unite the people in a union from the years of 1861 to 1865. I always feel like I need to mention that.
Well, you're right. It's become trendy among historians to kind of say we essentially constituted a new republic after the Civil War with the 13th through 15th Amendments, that, you know, that like that 47 years was sort of all we got. And then we had to start fresh. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm quite amenable. I wouldn't say that's like the objective truth, but also the like 1789. Or, I mean, look, I mean, we're here talking, there's so much to say, we're here talking on the 250th anniversary, but as we all know, and I mentioned this in my introductory series, the war started before 1776. The big constitutional document was written in 87. It was signed and ratified in 89. It fell apart in 61. There is actually the clear line that we want, or the people who are celebrating to, I actually resisted doing this series because I was like, I don't want to get involved in this 250 shit because it's a lie in so many ways. But then I just realized that's all everyone was talking about. So I jumped on board.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and honestly, right, like there's a version of it that is the lie, but what we're talking about today is also part of the story. Well, I mean, what's so interesting to me is you keep in your introduction today, and we kind of keep coming back to this question of historical memory, right? There's what happened, and then there's the kind of way that we have to sanitize certain stories in order to make them part of our mainstream accepted narrative. I think that the history that gets a little messier is a little bit more honest. And that is one of the points that I've tried to make in my last two books, certainly.
Yeah, no, me too. I think this is, once you start reading things, I mean, once you start reading the actual documents that came out from the period, you learn that the broad scale thing you were told is, I mean, so often it feels like the opposite of the truth. But I now need to go back to what I, the point I was trying to make about them being so orderly was not actually about how orderly the actual direct action was. Although it doesn't surprise me that they also threatened the lives of people. It's that what you described as a crisis seems to me not to have been a crisis for the people of Boston. They didn't care about the tea. They didn't have any money on the line, except that they were invested in both sides were invested in legality and the rules being followed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, although I would say they do actually care about T. I mean, that is another point that I make, is that like, even like, T was not 100% a luxury good. It was one of the reasons it had become inexpensive enough that like ordinary middle class people could still drink it. And so there was a way in which like, and that, and of the Townsend duties, right, of 1767, tea is the one that was actually going to earn the most revenue, right? Like, so it is a widespread enough commodity, but it's also hard to get, right? It only comes from China at that time. There are no Indian varieties, Darjeeling, Earl Grey, that's Assam, that's all 19th century British stuff. It only comes from one place. You have these various European companies with monopoly on it. Americans and British people alike were happy to drink smuggled tea that had been, you know, brought in by another continental European East India company. But the fact of drinking tea was popular. And in fact, there were a lot of Bostonians, including Boston women, who weren't willing to give it up. They're like, screw the Sons of Liberty boycotts. I'm going to keep drinking tea. They have these little rebellions against their own Sons of Liberty husbands. And they're like, we're going to keep drinking. So they do actually care about tea. Some of them care about tea more than they care about these legalities, right? It's the leading Sons of Liberty who are trying to warn them, like, look at these slippery slope things. If we allow one monopoly in here, there's going to be not monopolies on all sorts of goods. And since almost everybody in town is related to commercial shipping in some ways, right? Like, it's easy enough to make a common laborer understand, right? Like, this isn't just a merchant problem. This is an all of us problem. So they do care about the legalities, but I think ordinary people also understood the practicalities and, you know, were able to kind of look forward a few steps and being like, oh, well, if we start paying taxes without consent now, they'll be able to tax us into oblivion, right? Like, these are the nightmares that Samuel Adams and these other Sons of Liberty are constantly trying to warn them about in the pamphlet literature and in the newspapers.
Excellent. So, yes, I misspoke when I said they didn't care about tea. But the broader point is that they understand the legalities of the situation and the threats to the Constitution. Again, the lowercase c Constitution. Mm-hmm. They're worried about a new constitutional order. I mean,
yeah.
In the broad strokes, can't remember if I said this on any of the episodes previously. In the broad strokes, and you can correct me if this is wrong, I'm a literary theorist, you're a historian. The essentially what happens is the First World War breaks out, and it takes it's won by the British. And
wait, hold on. By the First World War, you're talking about the Seven Years' War.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. First war,
the OG,
World War, not the Great War, which is only called the First World War, starting in the 1940s. Right. But the actual lowercase First World War breaks out. It's won by the British, and once it's won by the British realize that they. The crown, this entity called the crown, has way too much debt, and they decide that it's time for the colonies, which have been more or less, this is a broad statement, anarchically self-ruled over the previous century or so, to have a much greater British influence, crown influence, let's say, and also start paying a lot more than they had into the coffers, money that the crown didn't need because the crown hadn't just fought a war on every continent. And now this is the new constitutional order that lies behind everything you and I have been talking about. I asked you to start with the Boston Tea Party, but now I'm starting a little bit before, which is there was a constitutional order that involved a lot less taxation and a lot less crown control of the colonies. And the question is that order has fallen apart after the Seven Years' War. And the question is, what will the new constitutional order be? And the people in Boston whatever they are okay with the new constitutional order being, this Tea Act goes farther than they are okay with. How does that all sound?
Yeah, the Tea Act goes farther than they were okay with. The Stamp Act had gotten, like, the thing is, like, the Stamp Act of 1765 had also gone too far. You know, lots of people who eventually become loyalists hate it to their core, right? But the British do repeal it, right? So, okay, they kick the can down the road, right? So then the British try again. Okay, what about the Townsend Act? So then the Americans object to that too, and they have boycotts, etc. And then Parliament's like, well, okay, so they repeal all of the duties, but they keep the tax on tea. And then there's threat of international war in the early 1770s. So everybody kind of pipes down about colonial resistance. But then the Tea Act comes, and when Parliament passes it, they're actually not even thinking of the American colonies that much. They're mostly looking to bail out the East India Company. And they're like, oh, all right, this is a solution. We'll just allow the East India Company to sell the tea directly to the American colonists. Maybe the American colonists won't say anything because it's actually going to make tea cheaper for them. Mm-hmm. But it's smart guys like John Dickinson, like Samuel Adams, who kind of smell a rat, and they're like, oh, you're trying to seduce us into obeying this law under the new constitutional order. And that's the thing that we have to fight back on now, just as we had fought back on against the Stamp Act of 1765.
Okay, so let's move forward a little bit. Finally, since I just jumped us back a little bit, when this happens, my eighth grade level understanding of the history is that the primary result of it is increased conflict between Massachusetts and the crown rather than a wider scale thing. And then over time, that conflict between Massachusetts and the crown metastasizes into the wider war. But
that does ignore a lot of stuff that was happening in South Carolina, Virginia, New York, Rhode Island, right? Like, there are definitely conflicts between the various colonies and Parliament. I mean, especially after 1765, but also all throughout colonial history, there had been tensions between the various colonial legislatures, the various, there had been uprisings in the 17th century, right? Things like that. So there had been a lot of stuff going on. We often focus on Boston because some of the most dramatic things happen there. I mean, the truth is that Boston, I believe that Philadelphia had actually sent its tea back before the Bostonians had the Tea Party, right? But nobody necessarily knows it yet. I might have the timing of that wrong. But the truth is, right, like, there are tea ships that are sent to Charleston, New York, and Philadelphia. And it's sort of an accident that it turns out this way. Like, the ship that was headed to New York actually gets blown off course to Antigua and doesn't show up until months later. And so at that point, yeah, the New Yorkers send the tea back, et cetera, et cetera. But it's through an accident of circumstances that, and one of the ships that was meant for Boston actually wrecks on the back of Cape Cod, and some of that tea ends up making its way on shore, actually. So we focus on Boston because that is where the big dramatic headline event happens. And Parliament was very focused on Boston because it seemed like they were hearing the most obnoxiousness from Boston. And so they get very laser focused on Boston. And it's like, oh, Boston's the problem. If we could just isolate Boston and Massachusetts, the rest of the colonies will fall into line. So you can kind of tell, like, the Boston Port Act singles out Boston. The Massachusetts Government Act singles out Massachusetts. But Parliament just basically finds out that they're wrong, that there's widespread support for the idea of not wanting to change the constitutional order in the way that that Parliament has been trying to change it.
Okay, great. I mean, I think at this point, I've now gotten everything that I wanted to make sure I got to related to the Tea Party. So the two things left are, what else about the Tea Party and the wider understanding do you want to make sure you explain? And then we've been jumping around, and I brought up immediately what the Tea Party means for historical memory and America 250 and everything. We can address that one more time. But first, just, what have I left out as I've sort of wound us and mentioned Herman Melville unwisely and that sort of thing?
No. I thought it was totally apropos. I mean, we could talk about, the role of women. We could talk about the Indian disguises. Another thing that we could talk talk about is some of the stuff that I have about the legacy of the Boston Tea Party at the end of the book, and the idea that there are people from lots of different political stripes who kind of take inspiration from the Tea Party. And, you know, so an interesting example, right, is on the one hand, right, like Martin Luther King, you know, offers the Boston Tea Party as a historical example of civil disobedience in his, you know, letter from a Birmingham jail in 1963. But then 3 years later, Robert F. Williams uses it as a rallying cry for more violent action in, you know, saying burn, baby, burn. And so you like, and there's, you know, and then meanwhile, there are all sorts of right-wing and libertarian groups who, you know, attach tea bags to bombs and put them in mailboxes and, you know, or dump copies of the U.S. tax code in the, you know, in Boston Harbor, or, you know, the Ku Klux Klan sees the participants in the Boston Tea Party as their forebears. So this idea of being inspired by the Boston Tea Party is not attached to any single political group. Lots of people use that memory for their own purposes.
Yeah, my friend Leonard Williams has been on the podcast several times. I forgot to mention this in an earlier episode, but he emailed me in respect to the Declaration of Independence discussion, and he said, you really can't find a revolutionary group after the Declaration of Independence who doesn't cite the Declaration of Independence, and that you really, it could be anyone. There's a long Marxist tradition of citing the Declaration of Independence, and there's a libertarian tradition of citing the Declaration of Independence. This claim that when you push us too far, we get to say enough is enough, and our current actions are not unconstitutional. They're in fact part of a deeper constitution, it's almost a claim that you have to make if you're going to take up arms or in some ways rise up against the constitutional order. This is the thing that Hobbes and Locke seem to me more similar than people want them to be. But Hobbes says you don't get to say, no, this has gotten bad enough that I'm throwing away the constitutional order. And Locke says you do get to say that. In normal times, Hobbes and Locke are fairly similar. Mm-hmm. But Locke says in extremes, you can do the Jefferson thing and be like, no, not anymore. The rules, you broke the rules, so we're going to break the rules. And Hobbes says, no matter what the king does, you never, ever, 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 ever get to tell the king the rules are thrown away.
Right. You don't want to live in a world without rules, is yes. What Hobbes says.
You don't want to live in a world in which anyone can declare, mm-hmm, we're going to temporarily live in a world without rules, because, mm-hmm, Hobbes says that temporary declaration will open the door to permanent anarchy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's seems pretty clear, and this is why you mentioned the Declaration, is like, look, we're serious about this. This really matters. People don't want to throw the constitutional order away every Tuesday. Right. They only start throwing the constitutional order away when it feels like it's worth throwing the constitutional order away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. What does it take to push people? And, you know, and that's why we often look to the history of the women's rights movements, the history of Black civil rights, well before the 1960s, by the way, right? Yeah. Gay rights, right? You know, that, you know, very often in an American context, certainly, you see people kind of saying, like, why should the laws and taxes apply to me if you are not recognizing my full citizenship? Like, I actually want to be participating in this, mm-hmm, constitutional order on an equal basis. Right. And, you know, and that's where, you know, that's the kind of liberal streak within this. Right. Like, and so, again, first you ask nicely, hey, can I have some rights, please? And when you're told no, then you start to think, like, all right, is there something more extreme I should be doing, at least to be heard? And then if they're still not going to listen, right, then you really do start to see some more extreme actions. I mean, that's true with labor negotiations too, right? Obviously, you ask for a raise, yeah, before you go on strike. There's ways to kind of see, if you look at the deeper history of any of these incidents, the slow building of the tension, right? Like the articulation of how two different sets of values are coming into conflict with one another, and the end point, right, is you know, are forms of direct action that, you know, that really try and upset the apple cart in a bigger way.
Yeah. So I tend to locate, people have heard this on this podcast lots of times, I tend to locate the direct action tradition, or let's say the philosophical justification for the direct action tradition, with Thoreau and Emerson. Obviously, the people who study anarchism as a set of ideas and anarchism as a European workers' movement of the 19th century and think those two are the same thing, they don't much like my argument that it's Thoreau who invents direct action, but because he wasn't part of the movement. His ideas became deeply influential in the movement in the later half of the 19th century, which is when the direct action period is, and there's the whole violent direct action period, which I can just leave aside for now. But I'll just say, for those of you who haven't listened, I did an episode with Constance Bontman about this, and one of the things that's very important is Kropotkin, and probably arguably the mainstream of the anarchist movement, always was against assassination. That has been forgotten. There were lots of anarchist assassins, but that didn't mean most anarchists believed in assassination. So I guess my question, and this is, you know, I've skipped Melville, but I'm going to some other New Englanders, is this tradition either the Tea Party directly, or just this something about Massachusetts radicalism that inspires something like Emerson and Thoreau, or is that too big a leap?
It's a tough question, right? I mean, on the one hand, like actually lots of New England literary figures and New York literary figures had ancestors who were members of the Boston Tea Party. I've never actually had the guts to write the article to kind of lay this all out, because it might not actually be a very good argument, but like Edith Wharton had an ancestor. Hawthorne married into a family of descendants of a Boston Tea Party participant. Like, you know, some more obscure figures as well. Nathaniel Parker Willis and Fannie Fern may have had an ancestor. Like, it's really interesting, actually, if you look at it. And I mean, New England dominates so much of literary culture in the 19th century and beyond that just statistically it would make sense that a lot of them were descended from Boston Tea Party participants, or claimed Boston Party participants. I do think that there was something in, we can lionize this too much, but in the organization of town governments, mm-hmm. and in the belief in covenanted communities and a certain strain of Protestantism that really doesn't like certain kinds of outside hierarchies, I do think that there's something that keeps that as a core part of New England thought. And maybe to some degree, especially as, you know, New Englanders try and say like our way is the American way, right? Like it is something that pervades a lot of American thought too. I mean, you know, Southerners had grown up in a culture that was a lot more comfortable with hierarchy, right? Yeah. With social hierarchy and various kinds. But somehow, right, we as Americans also inherit this New England tradition that, you know, a kind of Protestantism that's always looking for kind of new ways to do things, even if it means breaking off and forming your own sect. Sometimes it means getting a little bit more liberal. Sometimes it means getting even more strict and, you know, and even more evangelical, right? Like if you think of the New England Protestants that pour over the border into New York and the burned over district and, you know, leading to Mormonism and spiritualism and Millerism and Seventh-day Adventism and, you know, like, right, we think of these as New York things, but, it, you know, and it's the same area, right, as the Seneca Falls Convention and Frederick Douglass, but, you know, publishing his newspapers, right? Like, it's upstate New York, but it's an upstate New York that had been heavily populated by New Englanders after the Revolution, migrating over Lake Champlain, well, probably not over Lake Champlain, but around Lake Champlain into New York. I think there is a way in which there is something vital about this attitude and a sort of long memory of these tensions and a reading of English history of Hobbes and Locke, and even reading the ancient Greeks and Romans, right? Like there are Greek plays where people kind of say enough is enough and sort of I'm not obeying an unjust law, right? Like you can read that in the classics, and you had to know Latin and Greek to, you know, to get a university education in the 18th century. So I think they fuse a lot of this into American intellectual culture, but because, you know, it's also an elite culture, there is a desire to kind of also tamp some of that down and kind of say, well, we also want an orderly society. And like some of our founders are capitalists who want to be able to work their workers to death. So like ixnay on the revolutionary conversation, you know, but again, right, like that tension is there. And the only like the best thing to do is kind of look that tension full in the face by actually studying the full history rather than saying, well, let me just read the sanitized eighth grade version and call it a day, right? Like, let's actually lean into the fact that many of these famous events in American history are the end product of that tension. And sometimes we've been able to work out our problems through the law, right? But sometimes that's had to come after some kind of devastating crisis, not always arising from direct action, but like, you know, the Depression, right? Like, maybe time to do something about, like, you know, Social Security or something like that.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing I'll say is this is the really positive reading that I think you can give to Madison's Constitution, is that he was much more concerned with Locke than Hobbes. And he wanted to think, what can we do to make sure that this Constitution doesn't break? And he's reading Polybius, who says the Roman Constitution doesn't break because there is a strong central executive, but there is also a council of wise old rich guys, and there's also a place for the people. And the people don't have to take to the streets because they have the House, and then they have the jury, and eventually they get the Bill of Rights. And he says, well, the anarchy is always going to be there. Let me devise a system that can be a stable imperial system with anarchy, or they would call it democracy. But remember, when Madison is writing, democracy and anarchy are near synonyms. Let's build a system that can be stable because it accounts for a certain amount of anarchy. And the system falls apart when there's either too much of that anarchy or too much of the hierarchy. Obviously, everyone knows where my allegiances lie on this, but the system has been remarkably successful at balancing these forces over time. At least that's my broad reading of 250 years of history.
Right. There are many political viruses that, you know, that can be unleashed, and they did try and kind of build a kind of clean room to contain those viruses in various ways. But I also think that you're right, that there's a way that we can kind of, you know, go up our own orifices a little bit, being like, ah, the Supreme Court will save us because, you know, this is what the system was built to do, right? And I do think we have to remember, right, like, there's ways in which the Supreme Court can get politicized, and it almost always has been in American history. And the powers that has been granted or has arrogated for itself, this happened gradually. It doesn't, you know, spring forth fully armed like Athena, you know, right from the get-go in 1789.
And you can ask the people of Minneapolis whether you just have to do exactly what the Supreme Court says, or if you can come to the streets.
Right. And how will we be talking about that history 30 years later, right? How honest are we going to be about, you know, what it took to push back during that moment?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that I know that 30 years from now, they're going to be the heroic Minnesotans and ICE is going to be the fascist. The problem is that people are not, well, not everyone is saying that right now. And look, maybe I'm wrong about what the history books will say 30 years from now.
Well, if you just look at college campuses today. We have a proud student protest tradition, you know, and then more students protests happen. No, not that way.
Not those protests. The protests in the past were good. The current protests are bad. You've misunderstood.
I have a whole thing about this with women's rights, right? That like we only like lionize somebody like Joan of Arc, like after she's dead, right? Like you don't want to meet a live Joan of Arc, right? If you're part of the patriarchy, you know, you want to kind of celebrate a safely dead one.
Yeah. To bring him up again, Martin Luther King's, you know, liberal lionization, when the man was ostracized for being an anti-war socialist. That sums it up right there in a nutshell.
Yeah. And kind of reducing him to kind of one speech rather than the full body of the kinds of things that he was talking about.
Ben, this has been a real pleasure. Anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I'm good. I thought this was really fun. Thank you.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much.